Want a recipe for success? Step one, visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. Step two, click on my link to browse OCD Training School's amazing course catalog. Step three, enroll. And step four, enjoy learning. With no added cost to you, you can support the OCD family community while grabbing some continuing education or learning how to bridge yourself to self-help strategies for OCD. Again, that's OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And use my special link to sign up today.
Hi, fam. Why don't therapists bring a GPS to session? Because healing doesn't follow a map. It follows the client. But make no mistake, where people live, their culture, their traditions, those do matter. So get ready, fam, because today we're chatting with my new friend, Sindhu, the trailblazing OCD practitioner from Mysore, India, because she's doing incredible work and I can't wait for you to hear more.
I'm Nicole Morris, licensed marriage and family therapist and mental health correspondent. And let me be the first to say, welcome to the family, the OCD family, that is. I am here to create a community of support for family members, spouses, partners, parents, adult children, as there may be adult words, and chosen family of OCD sufferers and their community. I've had over 22 years of experience in the mental health field, but please note that this information does not qualify or substitute as a diagnostic evaluation, therapy, or treatment, and it is presented on an as-is basis. Please follow up with a qualified mental health provider in your area regarding concerns for yourself or loved ones. Thank you for joining us today. Now, let's get started.
Okay, fam. All right. Welcome back. Happy May for those joining us in real time. And thanks for coming to hang out with the fam. It's been a busy week around here, and we're also catapulting toward the end of the school year for my kiddos, so we've had field trips and testing and end of the school year to-dos, but I have to say, it feels really wonderful to be with you again. And today is exciting because I have my friend Sindhu, the good doc, chatting with us. And Sindhu has been nothing short of amazing. I met her last year, as you'll hear a bit later, through an International OCD Foundation Special Interest Group. And then there were holidays and travels and the fires in LA and all the things. So as I have told Sindhu, but I'll tell you as well, because hey, we're family and we just keep it real. I appreciate her patience. I'm so grateful for her time and I really value her sharing. Because today we're discussing how understanding cultural adaptations help clinicians provide care that's respectful, relevant, and more effective. Because therapy works best when it speaks the client's language, both literally and culturally. So let me tell you more about our special guest because we have lots of ground to cover. Sindhu B.S. is a psychologist specializing in anxiety and OCD, primarily utilizing the acceptance and commitment therapy approach. She currently works from her hometown, Mysore, India, and she holds a master's as well as a doctoral degree from the U.S. She has been mentored by prominent ACT experts, including Russ Harris and Lisa Coyne, and she is a BTTI certified practitioner by the IOCDIA, where she is currently the only professional, yes, I said only, only from India listed on their certified directory for OCD support. So without further ado, let's get to chatting. Well, welcome back to the OCD Family Podcast. And today I'm actually really, really excited. I know I say that a lot, but I feel very fortunate for getting to do this podcast and meeting with amazing people like today's guest, Sindhu from India. And she has practiced in Bangalore. She has been doing virtual since COVID. She is one of the only that we know of. If you're there in India listening, hey, Sindhu would love a friend. But she is the OCD practitioner in India. And we met months ago just out of a mutual interest of learning more and having a better understanding for treatment options. And so Sindhu, I'm so excited to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for hanging out with the fam.
Thank you so much, Nicole. Really happy to be here. Huge fan of the OCD Family Podcast. So feeling really happy to be here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And, you know, I'm thrilled because when we first connected, I think it was in the inference-based CBT realm, otherwise known as ICBT. So for any new fam joining in, if you've heard of that, we'll be talking about a number of different treatment modalities today. But also, we just got to talking about some of the differences, some of the overlap, some of the beauty and the challenges when we look at OCD through a cultural lens. And I just really enjoyed my conversation with Sinhu, and I was like, please, would you consider coming and chatting with us? So Sinhu, we're going to start today in talking about, if we can, just even more broadly, growing up, what was your view or your family's view, which probably did mirror culture, but also that cultural view of mental health? Would love to kind of hear what role that played, if any, and how it was regarded.
Yeah, so I grew up in a family where my grandmother had some kind of mental illness. We don't know what it is. She was suffering for a long time.
Yeah.
And my mother has OCD. So I saw up close how much psychological suffering, anxiety, and OCD can bring into a person's life.
Yeah.
And I think ever since I was younger, I was quite clear that I wanted to do something in the psychology, psychiatry, mental health field. But I don't know if you know about this, like Indians, we have always been told that you have to be an engineer when you grow up. So I was pushed into engineering.
Yeah.
So my joke always is that, hey, because I'm an Indian, I did engineering first and then I did what I wanted to do later.
Yeah.
So I had the privilege to get an internship here in my hometown, use that to write my GRE, go to US, do my master's. And I think something happened then because I went and did my counseling master's and then finally my clinical psychology doctoral degree. Like I think something shifted there where everybody kind of saw that, hey, engineering is not the only way out. Mental health is super important too.
Yeah.
So in other words, what I'm trying to say is OCD has been kind of like through and through my childhood memories with my mother. She still undergoes it even though she's in her 60s now.
Mm-hmm.
But the stigma is still quite prevalent, especially in her generation.
Yeah.
That mental health is very stigmatized. Like there's no way you can go seek it out, only if you are, I don't know what the view is, but I'm actually quite happy to say that things are changing rapidly. I think over the last two decades, more amount of millennials and Gen Zs are seeking mental health help. There's a huge amount of insight thanks to the internet, like everybody's reading up about it online.
Yeah.
But we still have a long way to go. I mean, India's population is 1.3 billion.
Right.
And statistics say that one in 25 people have OCD. So that's like more than the population of Australia or maybe like Italy or Germany or maybe like crazy. It's just the numbers are crazy.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's we have a long way to go, but things are improving. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean that, and again, family, if you think about what we were saying just a few moments ago, Sinhu is working essentially on her own in terms of treating OCD and actually trained in evidence-based practices for OCD. And so that has to feel really intimidating. I know my wait list is a couple miles long and I'm one of a few, but at least there's a few of us. I can only imagine if you think like the population of Australia, and most of those people are not going to know that what this thing is that they're dealing with, that they're coping with, that they're surviving is OCD. But of the ones that do, that has to feel like an immense demand on your shoulders.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Especially, I think once the BKTI training happened from IOCDF, which is currently the most sought after training, like intensive training for people who want to work with OCD, clinicians who want to work with OCD. I think ever since my name was put on IOCDF website, because if you type in India, like you'll only see my name.
Right.
I think this just opened up too many. I mean, my wait list is like 6 months long now, and I can't even promise something after 6 months because, you know, it can just go on for a year and stuff like that, right? So it's been really interesting. I think it's also quite, I feel quite honored that people reach out. And I think there's something beautiful about just people recognizing that they are undergoing OCD and they need help. And I think for me, that sort of feels like, wow, you know, that must have taken a lot of courage to do that, especially when the whole culture is like, you cannot seek help or this is just something that you can just deal with on your own. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's such a great point. And for anyone unfamiliar with BTTI, so that's the Behavioral Therapy Training Institute, which is sponsored and run by the International OCD Foundation. And if you want to get this premier training, which is highly sought after, you can wait. Speaking of waiting lists, you can wait for years. And it's not a cheap training. And it's something Sinhu and I were talking about before we even started recording.
just the process of getting in and through it is eye-opening. But at the same time, yes, once you're kind of designated and claimed by IOCDF as one of their own, because it's one of the main resource tools that people are looking at here in the U.S., but also internationally. And so that's a lot. It's a lot on your shoulders when it's like, okay, so it's Sindhu. Okay, so please. And I'm sure you get this too. If people call, if they leave messages, or they're like, you don't understand how dire it is. Everybody is like in super dire straits of needing help. And so it can add a lot of pressure. I'm curious. So when you were growing up, and are you an only child or did you have siblings?
I do. I have a brother, a younger brother.
Okay.
So I kind of was like the parentified child because I had to take care of my mother through her OCD journey.
I was going to say, I bet you were little mama. And partly culturally, there's also a role to step in and help with your brother, if I understand that correctly.
Yeah. Being a woman and also the elder kid, right? Like, so you have both the cultural norms dictating that you have to step in.
Right. And then you have mom is sick because she's dealing with this debilitating disorder and there's not a lot of knowledge about it. And even if there is, even when there is, culturally, it's taboo to seek help. Also, India is, and correct me if I'm wrong, I want to say it's a predominantly Hindu nation. And I wonder how much, because I know this can happen, you know, within Protestant or Catholicism or Judaism as well, where sometimes the call is like, I need to trust or lean into my religious principles, not the world saying I have this mental health thing, right? And so I wonder if part of that cultural reinforcement, too, is that you should turn to something like meditation or a spiritual practice when facing obstacles.
Oh, yeah. 100%. You nailed it. You are right. 8 out of 10 people are Hindus in India. And what is interesting, I mean, I could write a book on this. Like I keep getting too many clients with religious OCD. And India is home to 9 major religions. Like we have much more than that, but we have 9 major religions. And so I've pretty much like worked with Muslims and Christians and Hindus and Buddhists and Jains and Sikhs. And so you name it, I probably have worked with them. And the thing that I notice is that even though we have Muslims and Christians in India, they are Indian Muslims. They're Indian Christians. So they are culturally very Indian. And so they also get into this aspect of, hey, maybe I should just go, you know, enroll in this yoga institute, or I should just go practice meditation every day. So there's always this sense of, hey, there's more of this, you know, like eat, pray, love kind of spiritual journey that you can take in India, and that's going to solve everything. And of course, I can only imagine people who do that. Like some people do report feeling a lot of comfort in having a spiritual practice like that.
Yeah.
But I can see that backfiring as well. So it's very interesting how my work kind of has that full range of, you know, even if a Muslim client shows up and then I have to also work with what his religion says. In addition to that, I got to ask him questions about how the predominant Hindu, you know, Indianish thing has kind of played a role in his OCD as well.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I think it's such an important point. And what's interesting, I just did this metacognitive therapy training where they talk about this principle of detached mindfulness, but it is so different and separate than actual mindfulness. And I'm poo-pooing mindfulness. There's going to be some listeners that are be like, hey, this has made a huge difference. I know John Hirschfield talks a lot about incorporating mindfulness. There's plenty of great attributes, just like there's plenty of great attributes and values that we get from religious practices and whatnot. That's not the problem. It's what role it plays, how it's functioning, right? And so we could go into mindfulness and literally just sit in rumination. And that's going to be so distressing. But that feels like, oh, this is to be obedient kind of with this cultural norm, with this religious norm, with what I'm supposed to do, how you're supposed to handle things. I need to be gaining insight, or I need to kind of go into my third eye or whatever the thing is. And so I totally can imagine how that shows up. And it's interesting because we're going to be talking about, I think there's so many things we could talk about, first of all, Sindhu. So we might have to revisit for another episode down the road, because I think there's so many interesting places
we could.
Yeah.
But today, one of the things, too, we're going to be talking about is the role of how culture kind of infuses itself into stories, which becomes a big piece of treatment and inferential confusion and how OCD functions from, like, say, an inference-based CBT lens. But I was thinking, even as you were talking about going into some of those meditative practices, how I could imagine ACT, which is acceptance and commitment therapy, and how we can, like, let thoughts go, how we can use some of these ACT principles, I can imagine would be really helpful. And I don't want to get ahead of the story here. So I guess one other question, and then I want to hear all the deets on how you got into treating OCD and all the things. But I wonder, when you were growing up with your little brother and helping take care of your mother, helping take care of him, I wonder, did she know, did you guys know that what she was experiencing was this thing called OCD? And if not, she's gone, nope. You can't see her, fam, but I can see her. She's like, no, that definitely was not on the radar. But when did you guys discover that it was OCD? And if you want to maybe give an example of what that felt like, obviously want to honor your mother's privacy and your privacy, but to the extent that you feel comfortable sharing, what would you say?
Yeah, I mean, we never knew it was OCD. I think everything gets clubbed under stress. Like, it's just, oh, it's just stress, you know, it's just, you know, household chores that are just kicking in. Because my grandmother, who is my mother's mother-in-law, and then because India has a culture of living with your mother-in-law and father-in-law.
Yes.
So she had to do a lot of work in taking care of her and her mental illness. And no one kind of bothered to treat her. So I think my grandmother probably had schizophrenia. That's what we suspect, because we didn't know what it was growing up. And she sort of passed away when I was 10 years old. So I don't have many memories of her, but there was always distress in the household. So my mother had a lot of, you know, service to her. Caregiving to her. So we all assumed that her checking the door 10 times every day, or her checking the stove 10 times, 100 times every day, or, you know, just ruminating, or, you know, having panic attacks, were all just because of the way things were. I think it was only, like, recently, like, probably, I don't know, like 7-8 years ago, when I had a conversation with her and I said, hey, it looks like there's something else going on. You know, can we have a conversation about it? And then we talked about, where is this checking coming from? You know, what are those scary thoughts that show up for you? And does this neutralize, like, when you check 100 times or when you check 50 times, does it give you a sense of relief? And that's when it kind of, like, we had that explicit conversation that, hey, this is OCD.
Wow.
So,
yeah,
it took a long time. So 7-8 years ago would mean that she was probably in her, like, she was 55. And she has probably been undergoing OCD from 30 years before that. So,
sure. Yeah. Yeah, it's so interesting. And when you think of, so first of all, I will just say, like, for everybody listening, we all have multi-generational mental health, whether we called it that or not. A rose by any other name is still a rose here. And so we all have intergenerational mental health. Sometimes what's hard in growing up in a household where one of your parents, and it's having a light bulb moment for me, because we're going to talk a little bit later in the show about stories about magical thinking. And I'm going, oh, yeah, if you grow up and one of your parents is in and out of psychosis or having different episodes, and we think about growing up, there's family rules, right? And how family rules bend and change. Nowadays, like, when you're trying to understand reality and then you're told your version of reality actually isn't it, we call it, you know, a famous buzzword now is something like gaslighting. But if we think about, like, with schizophrenia, the person with that lived experience can't often sort out some of those pieces. And it's not to say they're always an act of psychosis, but then if they're helping lead and culturally have such an important role being the leader of the home and raising people where those rules change, there's kind of like this invisible rule, and kids are adaptable, so they learn how to hang in that, but it's so, so challenging. Then you can see when they have also their own mental health, as we all do, have our own mental health, physical health, spiritual health, whatever, how they had to become really, really skilled and really kind of on alert And then you add on that lens of OCD where false alarms, false alerts are going off so often. I have so much empathy for what that must have been like for your mother. And then for you growing up probably felt very similar, because even though you're not growing up under your grandmother's version of psychosis, you are growing up with her daughter that was raised in that environment. And so that environment is gonna be passed down to a certain extent. So that just lets me know there's so much pressure, I'm sure, already, and just your own lived experiences being a family member, which that's, Sindhu, you are right at home, because that's the OCD family community here. Family members of loved ones with OCD. And so that is such a important part of the story. What I will say too, and I was telling Sindhu, my brother-in-law is Indian. And one of the things I remember, even after he visited our home the first time, was talking about also like how important cleanliness was. And if you think about kind of the environment and different seasons, whether it's monsoon season or just different diseases, different debris that can come from the weather, a number of different things, you had to be really mindful in staying on top of cleaning. And he talked about how his mom, and she didn't have OCD, but he never knew what it was like to have a dirty home. Like, it was expected. It was unacceptable. There was always some kind of cleaning going on. And so I wonder, too, again, if we zoom out and go not just from an OCD perspective, but also just kind of, again, going the status of, if you're living a good life here, you need to be mindful of your role, and you need to be mindful of how you keep your house and how you manage things. And I imagine that adds pieces to it as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think even just to add on to what I was saying earlier, because 1 in 25 people have OCD in India, this is a curious experiment I keep asking people about, because India is a collectivist cultural society. You're not just having a nuclear family unit, like you're connected with all your extended family members. And it is super important to be connected with the third cousin or the second cousin. So I'm always curious about, hey, do you know anyone who is doing repetitive actions? Or do you know anyone who, because I don't think a lot of people understand what OCD is. So when I ask them about it, pretty much everyone I've met has said, oh yeah, I do know this uncle or this aunt who, you know, has OCD. So I think in some ways people are aware that there is something going on in the environment, but I don't think there's enough avenues or research or awareness even in the society that, hey, this is something that needs a different kind of mental health help. So, and yeah, coming back to cleanliness. So this is the thing about India that I find very fascinating, but I don't know if it is fascinating, but because I think India has like extremes of everything. Like I see this, you know, like there is a staunch atheist who is talking about rationality, and then there's a staunch Hindu who is going and doing all these rituals. Or you have, you know, like they're always talking about how your home has to be clean. And yeah, it is super important. Like we have the slogan, cleanliness is godliness or something like that. So it's equivalent to God.
Right.
But then you go out on the street and then there's garbage everywhere. There is, you know, street dogs everywhere. So it's a very weird kind of like opposite spectrum. And I think both coexist in India. So I think I find that very fascinating. But I also notice how that can act as different triggers for my clients. So for a client who was very focused on cleanliness in the house with contamination OCD, for example, he might find it really, really hard to go out because there's garbage everywhere. There are street dogs everywhere. And there's no way you can debate on that because there is literally garbage on the street.
Right.
So it's I think that's where acceptance and commitment therapy really helps. I strongly, strongly feel ACT is extremely suitable for the Indian context. And again, I could write a book on it because there's so much of insight I have gained over my work with all my clients. So there's a lot of this aspect of go out, and then actual triggers like rabies is still an endemic in India. So there is actual danger that exists that can just exacerbate OCD symptoms.
Yeah. And so many different pieces to the puzzle. I remember my brother-in-law visiting his mother, and there's some kind of rule, if I'm understanding it correctly, she needed to have a surgery and she had to have a family member there so she could be basically inpatient and outpatient, like it was required. And he got dengue fever when he was there. And he was like barely there. And he grew up there. And it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, I mean, there's constant things anywhere you live in the world. There's going to be certain things that are going to be more threats or challenges in the environment. But yeah, just going, there's no in between here. We go from the extremes. And what we know about a lot of people with OCD is it's very easy to get into that black and white thinking and see things as a binary choice between one extreme and another. So when you have culture reinforcing that, it adds an extra challenge. And, you know, we find that too, you know, whether it's in politics or whatnot, we don't hear a lot about the middle or the shades of gray. We hear the extremes. And that's part of what we have to understand we're working with when we look at that cultural context. So I think that helps kind of lead us in. You were talking about ACT, again, acceptance and commitment therapy. And I am really fascinated to know, once you started learning about mental health more, you knew you wanted to get involved from, it sounds like, a young age in the mental health field. But I'm really curious about how you got into treating OCD. And it sounds like ACT was the first, if not still one of the main methodologies that you use in treating OCD. So I would love for you to share about what got you into treating OCD, learning ACT, and maybe even some core principles that you found were really helpful from ACT.
Yeah, you raised a very good point in terms of the rule following and how that kind of functions in the house, right? And that's the tricky part about collectivist cultures like India, which is very different from individualistic cultures like America, I wonder, which is a lot of emphasis on conforming to the group norms or the societal norms. And the more you conform, the more you're loved and cared. So it's like a rule following kind of like comes very naturally from the childhood, I think. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a household where I was encouraged to question because my father was a scientist. So he was a bit more of a rational thinker. My mother was a physicist. So both of them came from science backgrounds, and which is very interesting because back in the 80s, 70s, you didn't see women becoming physicists. So
right.
My mom was one of the pioneers here in my hometown.
Trailblazer. Look at all of you trailblazers here in the family.
Yeah. So I was encouraged to question. I was encouraged to ask things about even like cultural norms or even magical thinking, like superstitious stuff that are quite common in our culture. It's only when I grew up, I realized I was the anomaly. Like, this is not normal. Like, most people are taught that, hey, you will only get love if you conform to these norms. Mm-hmm. Not me. Like, I didn't have any disapproval happen. But for a lot of people, there is a lot of pain of disapproval and rejection and kind of that sense of lack of belonging and stuff if they end up questioning things. And that can all lead to... Sorry, I feel like I'm digressing from...
This is wonderful. Because, too, we can see how that conformity is encouraged and reinforced. And I think that's a huge factor that you're talking about. But also, I have a feeling this is leading towards why ACT felt like it resonated a lot.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because there's no way you can debate your way around this. There's no way you can cognitively restructure what the client talks about, right? And especially, the other thing I've noticed that poses a significant challenge when you're working with OCD is where they have gotten those messages from. So because, again, India is a hierarchical country, you are taught to respect your elders no matter what from the time you're younger.
Right.
So whatever your elders tell you, that becomes a really important, significant guideline for your life. And a lot of people learn tricky beliefs, if I can call it like that, like magical thinking, tricky beliefs, where they feel like, hey, one of the popular Hinduism-based beliefs that everybody carries is that, hey, make sure that you're not thinking something bad or you're not saying something bad because there are gods and goddesses around who can make that come true. And Hinduism has a million gods. So
right.
There's always something for everything. So it's very difficult to debate, especially if the client says, hey, this is what my grandmother told me when I was younger. How can she be wrong? How can grandmothers be wrong? Or how can, you know, my father be wrong? So there's always this sense of respect. So there's no way you can sit here, take a step back and look at that part and debate against it, or, you know, bring in some sense of rationality, or even ask them to do ERP around it. Like, and I know I'm throwing a bit of a controversial statement here, but I've noticed exposure and response prevention, ERP, the protocols that come along, you know, they just ask them to kind of like, you know, go ahead and do this thing and let them learn how safe it is. It poses a significant challenge because this does stop people from even attempting or even talking about exposures. So I think that's where I started to kind of notice that ACT is extremely useful because ACT does not involve debating or lecturing you to think differently or advising you to think positively. ACT is all about looking at how is this thought functioning for you? Is this thought helpful and useful? Does this belief or this thought take you towards the kind of life you want? Does this thought help you to take effective action?
So ACT is, if I were to kind of paraphrase it, more culturally sensitive to the belief doctrine. Like, we don't need to challenge the belief doctrine that we should respect our elders. We don't need to challenge the belief doctrine that there are so many gods and you could manifest something with your thoughts. In fact, it's a bit of a fool's errand because that's not even the point of treatment. The point of treatment when it comes to something like you were mentioning, and just for newer family joining us, exposure and response prevention, or ERP, is that it's not even about the content. Like, we're not challenging the content. We're challenging the learning that our brain has done around when we engage in compulsions or not. And so good ERP requires us to look at, what's my core fear here? And my core fear might be I could cause harm by a dangerous thought. So that doesn't mean we need to disrespect a cultural practice or tradition. It means we can set up an exposure around targeting that core fear of, I'm afraid a thought could bring harm to somebody I care about, and then resisting or avoiding the compulsion, which, if you're listening and new to this, you're like, if we could do that, we wouldn't have OCD. It's not easy. You're right. Valid. And that's why ERP, while it can be done in kind of a self-help way, and sometimes, depending on where you are in the world and your access to treatment, it has to be done that way. But that's why it's so helpful to have a therapist guide you through that, because if it were so easy, we just wouldn't, right? Like, duh, we just wouldn't. But what can often get confused is we're kind of doing sensational exposures, or maybe we're challenging something that we're not even realizing, maybe because we're from outside the culture, or maybe because we didn't think of it that way. But you're sitting there going, like, the client is like, I am dissing my grandmother's legacy by even thinking about doing this. I can't do that. I would be a horrible person. And so you really have to listen to the client, because when it's not about the content, and ERP really isn't, it's about the, when I don't do the compulsions, my brain lets go of that really sticky intrusive thought, because I learn that actually it was just a thought. Thoughts are thoughts. And so the point isn't to challenge these deeply held beliefs, particularly that are so important to your family, to your culture, to your personhood, to your identity. But that can get missed. And I don't think people often intend to get that missed, but still there's room for improvement. And I know that's what a lot of the training and research efforts, et cetera, especially as it tries to expand outside of more Western culture, is aiming to do, but there's definitely work to be done. So you were talking then about getting involved with ACT, and there's a different way that you can engage with your thoughts. And it is very, I'm sure this is a huge plus as well. It's very conscientious of what the person values and how to incorporate moving towards your values. So it's absolutely going, respect your elders, and we can engage or not engage with thoughts in different ways. And so did you learn ACT during grad school, or how did you come to learn ACT?
Yeah, I mean, I was given a little bit of introduction to ACT during my grad school, but I think it was mainly traditional CBT, like the 70s version of CBT that I think I ended up thinking I would practice after coming back to India. But it didn't work that way. So all the cognitive restructuring and everything just landed really badly. And I think that's when I started to look for what else is out there. And I came across Russ Harris, Stephen Hayes. And Russ was running a really helpful online discounted program, a training program for people from developing countries. Mm-hmm. And that was extremely helpful. So just to get to know Russ up close and personal, ask him all kinds of questions. And he was my personal mentor. He's played a huge role in my life. I help him out with his Facebook group. I help moderate. So I'm sort of like, I'm doing ACT pretty much every day because I'm constantly involved in it.
Can I ask real quick, Sinhu, is that an open Facebook group, something that we could share about? Or is that something that you're like, oh, we don't have the bandwidth for that?
I mean, you'd still need to sign up.
Yeah.
And I would still let you in, but it's only for clinicians, though.
Okay.
It's called ACT Made Simple. I think that's the name of the Facebook group.
Gotcha.
So, yeah.
I'm sorry, one other question. Can I ask, so when you took the ACT course for developing countries, and all these courses were for the cultural relevant context, so important. Is there a website there, or is that on your website at Aware Mental Health, or is there a place I could direct people? Because I'm sure listeners are like, I want to know more about that.
Yeah, Russ still runs courses on his website. I think it's called psychwire.com. And I think Russ still has, if I'm not wrong, I think he still has a 50% discount for people from developing nations. I think you would need to email the admin for it. But I mean, I would highly, if you're looking to get into ACT, Russ's courses are the place to start off. He does a great job in simplifying all the concepts. And once you have a set foundation done, then you can go ahead and do the other courses from, let's say, the originator of ACT, Stephen Hayes, and other people.
Yeah, so that's great. So I will have that on this episode's blog, family. I always have the show notes. I'll have information about Sindhu and all the amazing work she's doing. And so if you want to check out that resource, also, we recently talked with Mike Tuig. He talked about his Praxis course, also very, very helpful and very thorough in how it covers ACT. And so there's some resources if you want to check them out. But you started there and you were still an active part of the Facebook group. And it sounds like at least have some community support, have built some community support through your fellow ACT clinicians, which I love that.
Yeah, I mean, I've done a good number of kind of like involved work with the ACT parent organization, ACBS.
Yeah.
I was co-chairing the Developing Nations Committee for a while. I was on the board. Just recently, I kind of like the board tenure ended. But to just go back to what I was saying, that was a huge game changer because the more I started to work with ACT, it did something like I saw that the treatment outcomes were really, really good. But what was interesting was a lot of people would just show up to therapy, again, thinking that they have stress or just panic or just marital stuff going on or family stuff going on. But then you would start to notice it's actually not that, it's OCD. And I think that's when I reached out to Lisa Coyne, who is a big name in the OCD world, OCD ACT. And again, I've just been so lucky to have met clinicians in the US, in Australia, Russ from Australia, who understand how tricky it is for a person from developing nation to afford these things. So Lisa also offered me a discounted rate and I would show up to her supervision sessions. And that was like huge learning.
Yeah.
I learned so much about how ACT, when ACT informs exposures, how beautiful therapy can just end up becoming.
Yes.
And then the BTTI happened. So,
yeah. Oh, I love that. All right, bam. If you're getting value out of our conversation, but you haven't hit subscribe or followed OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts and YouTube, please take a moment, no time like the present, to hit that button. It's free, it's easy, and it ensures that not only will you never miss an episode, but that more folks can find the OCD Family community. Because fam, we know we're better together. Now, back to today's chat. And so you got, if I remember correctly, in 2022, you got BTTI trained. That, again, is a creme de la creme ERP training that is put on by the International OCD Foundation. And again, I'll put a link over to it. I'm pretty confident if you're interested in getting trained, it'll be a hot minute. But doesn't mean you shouldn't get on the list. If you're interested, you should get on the list. But what I will say is, it sounds like ERP came later. I'm curious because we met through a group. I think, was it the SIG meeting? Yeah. I'm like, was it a listening session or a SIG meeting? Because I did so many meetings. But so the International OCD Foundation, otherwise known as IOCDF, has an ICVT SIG, which is a special interest group. So SIG is just an acronym. We are acronym soup over here. So bear with us, fam. But we met at a meeting there and connected and started chatting. during the meeting between one another to kind of touch base on some of these things. And so how did you first hear of ICBT? Again, that's inference-based CBT. And I'm wondering, just kind of in the timeline of things, we have ERP came in between LISA and BTTI around 2021, 2022. And how did ICBT fold into that?
I think I probably heard about ICBT, like how a lot of people heard about it on the Facebook group through Carl Robbins. Like I remember his posts about ICBT. He was just giving out glowing reviews about it. And I was very curious about what's this new thing. And then I became part of the ICBT Facebook group. And again, ICBT really spoke to me because of the narrative form of how to do it. And I think I still have a long way to go in terms of just getting better at ICBT. But it's so interesting how I can notice that, hey, I don't have to push someone for a particular kind of, like, a lot of people don't respond with ACT as well. So it's not like ACT is the one size fits all approach. A lot of people don't like some of the values conversations we have or the cognitive diffusion strategies that I want to bring in. Mm-hmm. And I notice that when I shift over to choosing some sprinkling of ICBT a little bit, and if it resonates, I continue with that. So it's been really interesting how there's so much of choice, even for me as a clinician, and the pain of stuckness or the pain of, oh gosh, like I don't know what I can do with my client, or why are we just stuck in the same place as we were a couple of months ago. I think that grip has slowly loosened the more I've gotten to know ICBT.
Yeah.
And now bringing in metaphors into sessions, and I think ACT has a lot of emphasis on metaphors. Mm-hmm. Bringing in metaphors there and then creating obsessional stories around it. So just, it's like a really nice mixture of ACT and ICBT. I mean, I could speak about that more, but I'm just noticing how enriching sessions became after I got to know ICBT more. So it's been very interesting how the leveling up happened there.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of like cooking in the kitchen, and you can make an amazing meal with the right spices and a good pan. And an understanding of heat and all these different things. And it can be really simple and turn out beautifully and just be one of the most amazing things you've ever eaten. But also learning more tools, gathering more tools. It doesn't mean you always are going to use every tool in your kitchen, but the things that you can create and the dishes and the ways you can explore flavors and enhance things or try it out and go, oh, that wasn't as good. I'm not doing that again. But experiment. And if we go back kind of to your scientist roots, then being able to be curious and experiment and have access to different tools really can open up treatment possibilities. And because we don't have a cure, it's a wonderful thing to have multiple tools. One of the things I really like about ICBT, and again, it's not so much about the content, but how we're reasoning and how our reasoning errors and imagination can lead us to confused conclusions. So I think I like ICBT because it's really validating in how you came to your obsessional story in the first place. Like, that makes perfect sense why you would be so concerned about checking the stove 100 times. Because when we follow out that obsessional sequence and we kind of see where that doubt led, that made all the sense in the world. So again, very affirming of how you were processing it and being honest that outside of obsessional content, that same reasoning serves you really well. So why would you question it here in this slice? But being able to see that in OCD, we have something we call inferential confusion. And we're not going to go into a deep dive on ICBT because there's a lot to it. But to just know, like, okay, there's an ability, especially when it comes to obsessional content, there's a mechanism that we understand called inferential confusion, where we're confusing imagined possibilities with what's happening right here, right now, and our common sense and our five sense data. And so I would imagine, again, if we look at the cultural context of, well, grandma said this, grandma is the business, we respect her fully, and I don't want to question that. Again, it's not even about the content of grandma, but it makes a lot of sense why the reasoning and why the consequences and why the distress and why the compulsions felt so important, because we're really worried that we were protecting grandma's honor. And so you can still protect grandma's honor and learn this reasoning error of where you went into this obsessional story. So that kind of brings us to what we were initially kind of talking about when we first met. We were like, oh my gosh, I want to have a chat about how our stories, the stories we tell and construct, and how stories, even their role culturally and in families and tradition, are passed down, you know, and I don't even know, several hundred years ago, everything was oral tradition. Everything was passed down through stories. And so I would love to know how you have seen that role of understanding kind of obsessional stories from a cultural lens, like how that has been impactful in your work. What role do the stories play?
Well, I think this whole aspect of OCD as a storyteller lands really, really well. Because you are right. I think India is a country where stories have always been a huge part of our culture. Again, I don't know anyone who has grown up with their grandparents and haven't heard stories every night from their grandparents. It's a very normal thing, sleeping with your grandpa or your grandma and then just hearing all kinds of stories. So I think this whole aspect of, hey, OCD is a storyteller who is kind of like having a structure, like, you know, how is the story constructed? Like when you look at how obsessional stories are constructed, there is a certain structure to it, right? And my usual go-to metaphor is, hey, think about this Bollywood movie, which is all about love stories. And Bollywood, we talk about, hey, like, let's pick this big famous movie director and let's talk about how he builds his movie, how he creates movies. And you see that, hey, there's a European location involved. Hey, the hero and the heroine are like fighting in the beginning and then they fall in love. Like you can expect, like you can anticipate that all these ingredients make up a really good love story. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly how OCD is like. Like OCD has a bunch of things that it takes in and then creates an obsessional story. But then when I'm leveling up, what I really liked was how ICBT stresses importance on, hey, where is that abstract fact coming from? Or what are those rules that OCD is picking to form the story? Or, you know, just possibilities, you know, like, oh, it's possible, you know, the master stroke by OCD, right? So so it's kind of interesting how you get curious and you slow down and you look at how the story is being constructed. And I think that really helps people to just really be able to step back for a second, separate a little bit from the activities of OCD and look at it as a story that OCD is saying. So again, from an ACT perspective, there was already this sense of, hey, your mind is a storyteller who is creating all kinds of, you know, facts and opinions and ideas and suggestions and stuff like that. And we can take a moment to call out that story. And now it's just more enhanced with ICBT adding in a little bit of that structure and more detail to it, I guess.
Yeah, I like that. So like helping to recognize the formula and being able to see, I love it, whether it's Bollywood or Hallmark movie or whatever kind of rom-com or whatever, we could go, yeah, there's always this kind of element and this kind of element, and it leads to this kind of element. And if it doesn't, if you actually see a film where that doesn't manifest in that way, people are like, what? Right? Because that they've come to expect, they've learned like, wow, that went outside the formula. But I would imagine in a culture too, where there is or has historically been, at least some of the newer generation, as you were saying, is kind of branching out from this, but to reinforce that norm or conform to the norm, then understanding like, well, it makes a lot of sense that your brain is building this formula then, right? Because that's the norm. That's how this story goes. And it can be really convincing, but then being able to look at the different tricks that OCD can pull over on people and the illusions that it tries to create. Once we can look at the formula, we can go, oh, I see how I fell for that. Yeah, I see how I got caught and swept into that story. And so that can absolutely be an amazing tool. And, you know, just even in thinking about how stories can play in, but also you were mentioning earlier kind of just even some of the traditions around superstitions.
Hey, real talk. If you've made it this far into the pod, chances are you love learning about OCD. So why not take it up a notch? Head over to OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses to browse the OCD Training School's incredible lineup. And when you use my special link, you're not just investing in great education, you're also supporting this podcast at zero extra cost. With courses ranging from self-help to continuing education for clinicians, offering live and on-demand options to fit your needs or your time zone, the opportunities are vast. OCD Training School has your back. And when you use my link, you have the fam's back too. So go check it out at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And now, back to the show.
We were also, in our conversation leading up to today, talking about how magical thinking is impacted by culture. And so I can imagine growing up in a family where your grandmother maybe probably had schizophrenia, your mother had OCD, which sometimes can look or feel very similar to psychosis when it's very intense. And then adding on the lens of the importance of different superstitions. And I think all cultures have some different superstitions. Some are ubiquitous, but there are some variations. I would love to kind of hear your thoughts on how magical thinking is impacted by culture.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, magical thinking, I think, is just super duper like part of our, like the way that we speak, like growing up. Again, I can't imagine. India probably has like, I can't remember the number, but I think India has like 18,000 languages, I think, like the whole of the country. And most people are multilingual. So any person I've met and had a conversation about it, we all have had some version of, you know, hey, say this word and then you will ward off the evil eye, or do this ritual through your hands or, you know, through a salt or whatever the object is, and you will be able to get rid of that curse. So there's always that sense of some word or some ritual that is attached to this aspect of having control over external outcomes. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, for some people, it doesn't lead to OCD. I'm not saying that magical thinking and culture leads to OCD, but a lot of people, I think, are not influenced by it. Even people with OCD, I don't think a lot of people are influenced by it. But some people I do know are quite influenced by using the same things that they've learned when they were younger as a mental compulsion or as a physical compulsion. So I guess, in other words, what I'm trying to say is it's just spoken very normally and naturally, like evil and karma and warding of the evil eye. Like these are all like very, very common. Like you see signboards everywhere here in India that says, hey, just come visit the priest or the astrologer and he should be able to get rid of whatever black magic that's been thrown at you. So I think, yeah, it's extremely normal.
Yeah,
I usually end up checking for some version of religious or magical thinking piece, no matter what presentation of OCD is there in front of me, because I'm always curious. I'm always just wondering if there is something like this. And most people are nodding their head and saying, oh, yeah, you know, if I said this out loud, whether it is health anxiety or health OCD, for example, if I said this out loud, I think it's going to come true.
Yeah. So it almost creates like a snitch culture with your own brain. Like my brain is going to think something and then, oh no, this is going to happen. Which if we think about OCD, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, it's interesting as you were describing how magical thinking plays out in everyday life. It did remind me a lot of scrupulosity and, you know, just it's not to say that your faith practice or your traditions or your cultural practices are wrong by any means. But we can see that, you know, sometimes it's a problem, an everyday life problem might be bogging you down, or it could be a mental health problem where OCD is being incredibly opportunistic and taking advantage of this is really important to you. You really value your family, you value your traditions, you value not cursing other people or having harm come to yourself, whether it's through a health diagnosis or to someone else. And so it takes advantage and you feel like, man, I'm not doing a good enough job managing it. But it's, you know, similar to what is said in the faith and OCD realm. And I know they will do a conference at least once a year for faith and OCD, but they talk about with scrupulosity, for example, scrupulosity is not a faith problem. It's a mental health problem. And so you can question and struggle and wrestle with things within your faith, but you can also have mental health hijack your faith and you're concerned you're not being a good enough whatever. And really, it's a mental health manifestation. That distress is coming from a mental health problem. And so being able to sort out those sources, and it's so important as we talk about, you know, in the faith realm, And I would imagine just, you know, across all cultures as well, and it seems like it should be common sense, but it's sadly it's not, is that we should always be partnering with people in those different areas, in those different traditions. You know, if you're worried that you did get a curse in some way and you have OCD, then having that therapist, but also being able to lean into whether it's a family member that you can talk to, or whether it's somebody, I don't know if it would be at a temple, or if you're stopping, you're seeing the billboard and you're stopping by somewhere, but being able to build some of those relationships. And I would imagine in a culture that's predominantly like mental health, no, that can be hard to find some allies out in the community. I would just imagine that's one of the challenges.
You raised a very good point, because I think that's what I leverage on. I think it's really important to have a lot of open conversations about cultural beliefs and religious beliefs. And I do, for the most part, ask them to talk to an imam at the mosque or the priest at their temple, and then come back with some scriptures that really speak to them. And religions do try to teach harmony and give out the message that God is benevolent. And I kind of leverage on that. And that really brings comfort to people, because a lot of people end up wondering if doing ERP, or if, because they would have read something, let's say on Reddit, for example, that can take you away from God or take you away from your culture. So I think this is comforting for them, that you can loosen the grip of OCD in your life and be connected to God. In fact, it is going to bring you closer to God if OCD is not interfering so much. So
yeah, absolutely. In fact, I'm going to look real quick, because Bronwyn sent me a slide, and this happens to be, I feel like I named it something that would be easy to search. We'll see. Ah, yes, I did. How excellent. Okay, plot twist. See how we just rearrange things in real time. But yeah, as you were talking, it just reminded me of this slide that she sent me at one point on how OCD hijacks faith. And this is from a more ICBT standpoint. But I think whether you're using ERP or ACT or any modality, evidence-based practice, this is going to be true. Like, actual faith, like you said, brings harmony. It brings someone closer to their higher power, to the gods, to their family traditions. It's going to fill someone up, not bring them more pain and suffering. And some people, I think we all can kind of hear in the back of our head, people are going to be like, pain and suffering is an important part of my religious practice or my faith practice or life practice. And it's not saying it can't, but is it a value-driven pain, like a good pain, something that has made you better? Or is this an intrusive, fearful pain that feels distressing that might turn out in the worst possible outcome? Because that's a different kind of pain. And so you can just, even in being curious, asking how that pain's functioning, say, is this something that is more congruent with maybe the magical thinking or cultural traditions or faith practices versus OCD, where that pain is going to be like, oh, but all these bad things could happen. And it's a fine line, right? Because you're talking about how so many of the different superstitions or magical thinking are going to have the, okay, if you think it and say it, then you're bringing it. And so we don't want to overpathologize faith, culture, different magical beliefs that are important to your family history, to your country's history, to your ethnic history. All of that is really important. And then also, are we engaging out of a desire? We're moving towards something in ACT and in values work, we would talk about kind of moving towards the values, or are we fueled simply by fear or disgust or one of these other distressing emotional states? And so I've found that to be helpful, and I'll post it over on this episode's blog too. I'll double check with Bronwyn that she's posting that.
I want to know more from an ICBT lens. I don't think I've explored that from an ICBT lens. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting, because I think it's really hard, especially when OCD, this is not to downplay anything or any experience that feels more external, but when it comes down to mental compulsions and mental thoughts and rumination and how what we think, that thought-action fusion, like how that can have such an impact on what happens. And what you're talking about really is like super culturally prevalent is that thought action fusion, which is simply to say, I had that thought so that things happen, right?
I mean, culturally, like you do hear an elderly person saying, oh, see, like this happened because yesterday you said this, or because you did this yesterday and this happened. So there's, it's this constant reinforcement, even from the external world.
Yeah.
Where people who you look up to, people who you find very credible, are also saying the same thing, that, hey, they're trying to kind of like link two events, and that can just cause more distress, I think.
So at what point would you recommend for anybody listening that may be like, yes, this is my everyday experience, how do I sort out, is part of that just I did cause that because I said that thing yesterday, or maybe am I dealing with OCD? When might it be helpful for somebody? And again, sometimes it's just going to be the loved ones listening, going, they can't see it for themselves because they're pretty absorbed in this, but I see it for them. They're definitely having some struggles that are beyond just kind of our normal cultural practice. But when would you suggest somebody seek out and see if OCD might be a piece of the puzzle, if this might be more than just them trying to be a good person and follow their good practices, but OCD might be hijacking some of the really valuable, important practices?
I think two main factors would be to see if a lot of repetitive behaviors are happening on your end. Like, is it just about linking cause to an outcome, or is it just like happening everywhere? Because that's what OCD does. Like, it just links everything and anything to an outcome. And the second thing, I think most importantly, is your life getting smaller because of what's happening? And I think that's a major factor why people show up to therapy, because they would have stopped engaging in their lives and missed out on a bunch of things. So in essence, from a larger perspective, magical thinking is not really a problem. It actually gives comfort to a lot of people, but it's only when it starts to make your life smaller and less fulfilling and purposeless, I think that's when you probably might have to seek help.
Yeah, that's a really great point. So when we think about OCD, we'll often use these words. They sound fancy. Feel free to use them in a game of Scrabble or at your next trivia night. But we talk about whether something is egosyntonic or egodystonic. And so egosyntonic is something that's going to be more aligned in and desirable for your life. And so even if you're having pain, it's moving you towards something, right? So if I was like, I'm going to start lifting weights, I might have some pain in my muscles, but that might be a productive good pain because I'm practicing something that's moving me towards something. And that pain's not going to last forever. But also, there's, on the flip side, egodystonic, and that's what OCD is infamous for. So that is like as far as we could get from what we'd want in life from all of these things. So if I want to respect my elders, I want to say the right things and manifest the right things and rid of the right things. All of this should, if it's egosyntonic, be moving me more towards that value-driven life, more meaningful relationships, more meaningful engagement in the world. And if it's not, and instead my world's getting smaller and smaller and I'm afraid that it's all my fault, and it just continues to shrink, if it's adding that distress, if it's taking a lot of time. We say in the OCD field, you know, at least an hour when we add it all up in a day. But I don't think I've ever met somebody that's like, yeah, you know, we just barely hit an hour of how distressing OCD is. Like, people don't come in for that level of distress. So if your world is shrinking and you are feeling distressed and it isn't resulting in any kind of joy or harmony, was the word, and I think a really impactful word, if you're not feeling any semblance of that harmony, then considering, you know, maybe it's not just that I am screwing up and not practicing any of my traditions well and just the worst, but my mental health is absolutely hijacking my practice of these meaningful traditions. And that's where it can be really, really helpful then to sync up with a therapist. So we have some information here. We have Sinhu is working with Aware MH and Aware Mental Health. So if you jump over to this episode's blog, you can check out their website at awaremh.com. And there's certainly different resources. She's mentioned that ACT clinicians group if you are learning ACT or if you want to check out some more of those trainings. And again, I will highlight those over on the blog here. But just maybe as we wrap up, Sindhu, any kind of last thoughts or notes for maybe family members? So many times I think when we have these conversations, family members go, oh, just like you said before in being curious, like, oh yeah, my uncle was kind of like, yeah, no, of course there's other people in the family. Sometimes family members themselves feel guilty for missing it or for not supporting it sooner, like they could know before they knew. But do you have any advice or thoughts for family members that are trying to strike that balance between living honorable and harmonious lives and also wanting to prioritize mental health in this kind of new emerging landscape where it's kind of okay, we start to see influencers and Reddit threads and things about mental health? Like, what would you say to family?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. I don't have any data to back this up, but I've noticed that when family members step in and sort of, in a way, embrace the uncertainty and also give comfort that I'm sure for you. So, for example, if a person undergoing OCD is saying, oh, shoot, you know, I touched this thing and then I'm going to fall terribly ill, usually family members are just dismissing it or saying something like, oh, you know, you're just overthinking or nothing like that is going to happen. I've noticed that if you said something along the lines of, oh, I'm so sorry you're feeling this way, you know, it sounds like OCD is pushing you around a lot, that's okay. We don't know what's going to happen. This may happen, this may not happen. Whatever happens, I'm here for you. I'm here with you. And we will kind of ride this wave of anxiety and wait for what happens. I feel like I know it doesn't kind of land like as if you're comforting your family member with OCD. And I know it's tricky because like ICBT emphasizes more on functional certainty, I think, and yeah, talks a lot about tolerance of uncertainty. So I know I'm probably giving some mixed messages here, but I've noticed with my clients, at least there's a sense of, hey, I'm here with you and we will deal with whatever happens, rather than dismissing something can be useful. Like, can at least help the person let that anxiety wash over them a little bit while they deal with it. What do you think, Nicole? Like, I'm curious about your take on uncertainty.
I think it's a really good point. If you look at the research that Ellie Leibovitz has done around programs like SPACE, and this is Supportive Parenting for Anxious Childhood Emotions, I believe is what SPACE stands for. It talks about in a family setting that whether it's the person themselves engaging and performing the mental or physical act, the compulsion or the avoidance as a compulsion, or if it's the loved ones around them, a best friend, roommate, a family member, a spouse, a child, it could be a young child. I'm sure there were many things you were doing to help your mom where you're like, oh yeah, that was me. That was my role. And I felt like it was dire. I had to do that for her sanity, for her safety, for all of us, right? And so what I think the research has found in something like SPACE is that even when a family member, a loved one, engages in the mental act or even dismisses it, because sometimes someone's seeking reassurance and they're like, you think that's the problem? And they're like, no, that's nonsense, right? That dismissal is a compulsive response and you don't always know it. So family members are sometimes like, I don't want to talk to my loved one because I'm afraid I'm going to somehow reinforce this. And it's one of the, I think, hardest things, and was one of the pieces where my heart was even in starting the OCD family community, because people are just trying to love their loved ones well, and they're just trying to give them some comfort and love. They're not trying to do anything bad or malicious or anything. And you're right, you're not doing something bad or malicious, but OCD is so opportunistic and so sneaky that it will hijack that. And now, whether the person is doing the compulsion or not, it takes your response as the compulsive response. So I think you're absolutely right that you can still support your loved one, and it'll be an adjustment. So it might feel kind of hard to just go, I'm sorry you're hurting right now, and not provide that certainty. Particularly as you were talking there, Sindhu, I was thinking, you know, you were just saying culturally, like, this leads to that. So if I don't say this, or I don't do this, or I don't do the hand wave in this way, then it can lead to that. Like, there's so much building uncertainty in that cultural context, sometimes going like, well, you don't need to have certainty. It just feels like gobbledygook to somebody going, and I don't even know if that gobbledygook, it sounds like nonsense, right? To somebody that is like, our life and principle is built on certainty. But like you said, and for people that aren't as familiar, you know, ERP and ICBT, there's differences in uncertainty versus functional certainty. The way I kind of distill it and simplify it down, because it's helpful for my brain, I tend to think in analogies. So if it's helpful, yay. If it's not, I'm sure there's so many great ways to think about it. But I almost think about it as, if we're looking at OCD as this animal, like an elephant. If I look at an elephant front forward, I see this big floppy ears, this long trunk, I see these big feet, I see this big animal. And, you know, elephants are smart, and maybe the elephant is acting in one way or another, but that's what I see. If I only see the elephant from the backside, then I see a big rump, I see a big tail, I see those big feet, but I maybe kind of see what I don't know, unless I can have that context and understanding our floppy ears. But I just see kind of the mass. Which one is the elephant? Well, they're both the elephant. And so we can look at OCD from an uncertainty standpoint. We can look at it from a functional certainty standpoint. They sound opposite, kind of, because they are. They're kind of starting in opposite places, but the elephant is still the elephant. OCD is still OCD. And so it can be hard to know what to do with that. But I would say it makes a lot of sense. And a lot of people practicing ERP currently are espousing more and more that you don't have to necessarily have a tolerance of uncertainty. That's kind of been a newer development from my purview, because when I learned ERP, it was completely and almost totally about tolerance of uncertainty. But there's certainly people out there practicing ERP that say you don't have to tolerate the uncertainty. You don't have to believe that you're a pedophile or that this outcome or that outcome absolutely is going to happen. And maybe it is and maybe it isn't. You don't have to always take that stance. And so I think, you know, what would be important, particularly if someone is coming from a cultural context where certainty plays such a, in many ways, beautiful and harmonious role, and maybe even functions as functional certainty, but it plays a role, then being really mindful about the language we use and adapting. I think you could do ERP, you could do ICBT, you could do ACT, you could do all of them well, you could do none of them well. It all is kind of in the implementation and seeing the person in front of you. Like, these models are great, but they're nothing without the person in front of us. We have to consider the person in front of us and what their needs are, how things are functioning, how it's impacting them, the level of severity. There are a lot of factors there. So it was kind of a verbose response, but I think you're exactly right. And I actually think there is research to show it, because a lot of talk even around phrases like family accommodation are talking about exactly that, that, you know, how we respond if we're dismissing or just, you know, they're really panicked about the door. It's just easier for me to open the door. Otherwise, it's going to take us an hour to get out the door. I'm just going to open the door for them. Whatever the thing is can actually reinforce OCD at that time. So when in doubt, you can just, I say this too, when in doubt, zoom out. So we can still comfort the person and not give them a solve on that. Like, wow, you're really distressed about this. I'm sorry that you're hurting. I'm sorry you're in pain. I'm sorry this is so distressing. I think that's a great way of handling it. And I actually think the research supports that. So well done.
Yeah. As you were talking, I was thinking about my 8-year-old daughter. So in the night, sometimes when we are sleeping, she has a very imaginative brain. So she ends up wondering if an intruder is already in our house or if someone is going to come and attack us. And in those moments, I noticed that I tried to do some ICBT work, which is like slow down and ask her for some, like, is this a reasonable doubt? Like, is there any relevant data in the land of here and now that supports this? And usually that kind of helps. Like, she slows down. She kind of gets into her five senses experiencing. She knows that there is no one around.
Yeah.
And that itself is enough for her to trust herself and trust the environment. But sometimes if she says something like, oh, I'm super worried about going to school tomorrow because I'm worried my best friend is going to stop talking to me. And there's no relevant data for it. Like, it's just her imaginative brain worried about it. And in those moments, I think I usually say something like, let's see what happens. You know, let's bring in some curiosity. this can happen, this might not happen, but whatever is it, whatever happens, I'm here with you. Like, I'm going to support you through it. You can come home and tell me what happened. So, yeah, like you said, it's all about WTF. What's the function? How is this functioning?
That is a reframe on WTF, and I'm here for it. I love that. I'm going to have to borrow that. I will be like, my friend Sindhu, what's the function?
I use it with my clients sometimes, and it's interesting because in India, you don't really, like, the culture also says, oh, you're not swearing, or, you know, you're not saying all those things.
Yeah. Here in America, it would have a different context, but that's part of what I'm loving. WTF, what's the function? But yeah, you know, it's interesting. I, as a kid, had that intruder theme. My son, who has OCD, who is 11, sometimes has that theme. And I have found, you know, we used to do ERP only with it. And it was very much like, yeah, maybe. And if you're listening and you're like, why in the world would you ever tell a child that there might be an intruder in the middle of the night? And again, you have to think about it. It wouldn't just be that in a silo, but you have to think about it in terms of the compulsions of no, there's not, and checking and all of these other things are sleeping with a light on. I don't know why, but the light is like the magic thing that's going to stop an intruder. They're going to be like, this house. Oh, wait, no, there's a light. I'm stopped in my tracks. Guess I'll go to the next victim. But, you know, there's a lot of different things that might show up there. And so if we are continuing to do what we always did, we're going to get what we always got. We're going to have OCDs, intrusive thoughts stick from that ERP perspective if we're continuing to engage in the compulsion. Again, though, it's important to find that core fear. And it feels outrageous that you would say to a kid or an adult, if you really thought like a murderer was going to come in your house at night, like, yeah, maybe they will. But again, in terms of how the brain metabolizes that over time in trials, in these ERP exposures, you find actually that thought diffuses at thought leaves, because once we stop reinforcing the compulsion, then the stickiness, the relevance, the learning that the brain has to protect itself from this thought, from this idea of the thought that is just a thought, leaves. But I found ICBT to be a lot more helpful too, and go, you know, okay, we don't have the evidence and the story is all that. And that makes sense. That makes sense why we're worried about that. And there's always interesting little factoids or clues that he comes up with. And I'm sure when I was a kid, I did too. But nowadays with the internet, so many different things. Like, he doesn't have full access to the internet, but he's learned that Siri does, and Siri will report back. And so he's like, so how many kids have been murdered in Indiana, you know, from like nighttime invasions, you know, just your average Google. And it'll be like, oh, this many. And I was like, what about a night? And I'm like, oh my gosh, stop it, right? And so it makes sense why that logic and reasoning was really scary. But also going like, oh, I got into the doubt here, and then it kind of just portaled me into my imagination where anything's possible. And it was like a scary movie. It was like it was a thriller. It was the worst kind of thing. And so when we can look and go, well, actually, we don't have any evidence for that, and we can actually trust ourselves. We can trust this. And we're really good. You know, my son really likes Zach King, does magicians videos, and sometimes he'll break down like how he pulled off the illusion. And so we'll even be like, how do you think Zach King would try to convince you that there's an intruder coming in the middle of the night? And then he literally pops out of it and he's like, yeah, it is an illusion. And my brain was trying to trick me, but this, that, and blah, 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 blah. And he can see it. And it's backed up by the facts, because in the here and now, there's just zero evidence that anything bad is going to happen. It's irrelevant if someone's ever gotten killed in the area, because that doesn't mean he's going to get killed right now. And so, and that might sound triggering, that might sound morbid for people listening that aren't familiar with some of these themes, but it's really powerful. And what I love about pediatrics is when they get it, they get it. It clicks. And they're like, yeah, I don't even have to go into that story. And whereas us adults, like, it's a little harder to let go some of our kind of ways of thinking about things. But yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, it depends on the time. It doesn't mean we never do ERP. We still do ERP. I think just the importance is, what's the function? And then also, like, what is the goal? So the goal, sometimes it might be like, oh, but, you know, I'm afraid of doing this thing over here. And it's like, is there even reason that you need to do this thing over here? Like, sometimes people are like, I don't want to pick feces out of the toilet. I do say, unless you, like, lost your wedding ring somehow in the toilet, which unfortunately had a mess in it, I don't think there's a reason for a lot of us to be digging through feces in the toilet. And sometimes, like, ERP will be like, let's do that to help your brain learn you don't need to be afraid of this. And sometimes we have to ask ourselves, no, like, we don't need to train our brain to be okay playing with poop. I mean, that's silly, right? And so it's not that ERP is bad and ERP is harmful. No, but any of these, ERP, ICBT, ACT, not done correctly, not with the right goals in mind, can be. And so it's really important to stay focused on that as well.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, because I think that's what freaks my clients out, because they would have read up a Reddit post where this person unfortunately has been to a therapist who has just ended up, you know, having an ERP hierarchy of all kinds of things for no, I mean, there's no rationale behind it. And they kind of end up worrying that, oh, I'm going to show up to therapy and then I'll have to lick the toilet seat or something like
right.
that. So
in what world do we need to lick the toilet seat? It's funny because there's a couple slide decks that clinicians in the ICBT field have created and shared for clinical use, which has been wonderful. And one of the slide decks, it's in module 5 or 6 of ICBT, talks about what information would you need to be present to show that this doubt is true, actually. Because there are times we have reasonable doubts based in the here and now, and those are called reasonable doubts. That's different than an obsession. And so I would plug that licking the toilet seat into that. In what situation, what evidence would have to be there that licking the toilet seat is absolutely necessary? Well, I suppose if someone put a gun to my head and said, lick the toilet seat or I'm shooting, then that's pretty strong. That's good evidence. Like, I better do it. There's worse things that are going to happen. But even in the, like, most crazy of thrillers, not that those are my favorite kind of movies, I wonder why, but even in the craziest of thrillers, has it come down to, like, the toilet seat now or you're gone? It's like, no, there's no world where we have to feel okay about licking the toilet seat. And I'm not coming after anybody listening that does ERP, especially if you've somehow had toilet seat licking in your profile. I'm not shaming or saying I'm better or whatever. I'm just saying we need to think about, why is that the exposure then? Because we need to be okay being able to sit down on it. Toilet, like, say we want to go on a trip and we need to be able to do that. Okay, well, that's not the same thing as licking it. So what is the purpose? I think if somehow this goes back to the core fear, and it's hard to understand how licking a toilet seat would go back to the core fear, go for it. But I'm kind of under the impression that you would kind of have to be like, it's a life or death situation for you or somebody you cherish the most in the world if you don't lick that toilet seat right now. Like, and outside of that, it's unnecessary. It's unnecessary. There are thousands, if not millions, of other ways that can be achieved. So, and I get it too, when we see like a snapshot on Reddit or clients see a snapshot on Reddit, also not presenting it like a clinical case vignette and this is why we're in treatment. They just might show you a picture of a hierarchy that may be great or it may not. And you're just looking at that snapshot, you're like, well, I'll save myself the money, the time, the freak out, the stigma, and just skip that. I would rather have a smaller world alive than be licking toilets. I can't do that. Well, guess what? Like, I'm with you. I'm not a toilet licker. And I don't think there's a world where you need to, short of somehow an unfortunate hostage situation with a very weird demand. But yeah, so those are kind of my thoughts. But yeah, we do see that a lot. And the internet, like, you're getting a snapshot. And so people are like, why would you do that? And you know what? Sometimes if you did have the clinical picture, you go, yeah, why are you doing that? I still don't think it's hitting the point. So it's a note for us therapists, anybody that practices listening, going, why are we doing that? And there may be a very good reason for a lot of the things we see out there. But there also may be, oh, because I thought that's what ERP was, that we're just supposed to be like sensationally exposing and learning to not care about the content. But like, even if you don't care about content, you like a person without OCD is like, I don't want to lick a toilet seat.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Yeah.
Oh, you're not. Who's up for like, this isn't a common practice. We don't have to embrace.
Yeah.
Being okay with licking toilet seats. So I'm on team. That doesn't make sense.
What's the ACT-informed, values-based exposure hierarchy really helps just to be able to bring that sense of what's the function? Like if OCD was not an influence in this person's life, what would they be doing? And just even curiously exploring that with the client, right?
Yeah.
Like what would you be doing if OCD was not an influence? And that itself could just open up 100 exposure
right.
ideas to do. So that's more than enough. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. There's just endless possibilities. And sometimes the clients have we might think of a bunch or have like a bag of go-tos for certain types of subtypes, but also like it's even better when they can come up with it because that's what's making sense to their brain. That's what they have access to practice in their life. They, you know, all those things. And so like we might have lots of great ideas, but nobody is beyond expert than them themselves. So like really being able to listen and that is absolutely key. Well, Sinhan, this has been such a great conversation. And I just really appreciate you sharing about your story and just really also helping us understand and be curious. I think if there was a theme that I would want to highlight and punctuate is that curiosity and having an open mind. And sometimes that might feel scary and countercultural. Like you said, you were like, I thought everybody was doing this and I realized they're not. But if we think about that, that's really important. That and the WTF, like on two levels, the WTF on how the behavior or mental act or physical act, the compulsion is functioning for the person with lived experience, but also how your intervention, whether it's ERP, ICBT act, how that's functioning, what goal are you trying to achieve with that? And if we keep those things in mind, it sounds like we're in a pretty good space. So I appreciate your time and coming to hang out with the fam.
Thank you so much, Nicole. This was wonderful. Thank you for giving a platform to a brown person from India speaking about OCD and just how it functions in my country. Thank you so much for that.
Absolutely. And let's definitely keep in touch. And yes, thank you. I'm happy we're better together and I appreciate you. Intrusive thoughts. Alrighty. So fam, we covered a lot of great ground there. And we even got to chitty chat there about some case scenarios at the end. But I just wanted to point out or note that for my son's intruder experience, while I discussed ERP and ICBT concepts with him and y'all, ICBT is not established for pediatrics yet in terms of treatment. It is emerging. It is growing. In fact, you may have even heard me talk about OCD training schools emerging practice for ICBT with kids. But I just want to note it because inevitably I know somebody's going to ask and be like, wait a minute, but can you do that with kids or how does that work with kids, etc. So I will know if you want to hear more about my son's story and hear us actually even talk about this very scenario. He was on the show a couple weeks ago and we were talking about just that. So you can check that out. I'll link that episode over on this episode's blog at ocdfamilypodcast.com. And I wanted to mention that the slide about the intersection between religious or cultural or moral scrupulosity and OCD from my friend and colleague, Bronwyn Schroyer, LCSW, is also going to be posted over on this episode's blog. The slide addresses that intersection from an ICBT lens and is adapted from Dr. Frederick R. Demma's work in ICBT. So if you're listening and want to check that out, you can jump on over to the blog. Thank you to Bronwyn for that. And also the citation to Fred's work is included. Okay, so that brings us to our intrusive thought segment, which for any newer family joining is my application segment of the show. It's that time where we try to apply what we've learned and how we might apply it today. Because sometimes it's like, gosh, this was interesting, but what do I do with it? And you know what, fam? I can't think of a better example than Sindhu's when she was like, WTF. Seriously, I love it so much. But honestly, fam, no matter who the OCD warrior is before us, whether it's our loved one, whether it's ourselves, whether it's our clients, asking WTF is so important. OCD treatment should always tie back to the function. whether it's of the behavior or the reasoning process or the value. But it becomes ever more important when we are exploring our WTF from a cultural lens. We can't adapt, respect, honor, or value someone's cultural traditions, history, beliefs without understanding the function. And we really risk missing the point or risking harm without those considerations. And that goes for any of the treatments, ICBT, ERP, ACT. I know it's not what people are intending. In fact, many practitioners are learning about these treatment strategies in their own silos. So this makes joining a community, whether it's a community of support here like the FAM, or even a clinician treatment community, a consultation group, or getting involved with organizations like IOCDF, OCD UK, NOCD, more important. Because learning is an ongoing effort, and we really are better together. So thanks again to Sindhu for illuminating a path and bringing the WTF of it all. Because her wisdom and guidance is making a difference, and the ripple effect continues to be far-reaching. And because Sindhu, she's not alone. You're not alone. I'm not alone. And there is so much hope for our OCD warriors.
Thank you for joining me and our OCD family community. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please like and subscribe to the OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Did you find this content helpful? Please consider leaving a review. The more people that know they're not alone, the better. For more information regarding today's podcast, please visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com and remember to join the email list while you're there. It will provide you with the most up-to-date information, resources, and the download on the family chatter. Oh yeah.
Says family, like Sindhu and me, saying WTF OCD.
That's right. I went there. And you can too at OCDFamilyPodcast.com.
Therapists, ready to shape the future of pediatric OCD treatment? Join the Next Steps in Pediatric OCD on-demand course from Angela Adamson Springer, LCSW, and learn how to adapt inference-based cognitive behavioral therapy for kids. With research still emerging, this course empowers you to explore new methods and contribute to the growing field of evidence-based practices. With OCD Training School's 365-day access for on-demand courses, you'll gain practical tools to help kids by adapting ICBT's signature 12 modules to be as creative as the kiddos you're treating. So sign up at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses to support the podcast at no extra cost and support further growth and hope for our youngest of warriors.